Welcome to the wrap party for season 4 of DIA Connections. Okay, maybe it's not a party, but it is a festive occasion. 4 podcast seasons. That might not seem like a lot, but consider this. The average lifespan of a podcast is only 6 months. So 4 years is pretty good. We're honored to tell DIA's story, both past and present, in our unvarnished style. And based on the feedback, you think it's pretty good too. And so do the people who vote for podcast awards. DIA Connections won its 3rd award last year for our show, Ukraine, Truth Be Told. It was one we did in season 3. Who knows? Maybe there's another winner in this season's batch. Okay, that's enough self-congratulatory chatter. Let's get to the teaser for Best of Season 4.
Right behind the nose cone, there is a warhead.
Show and Tell, Iranian UAVs in Ukraine, was our show about the DIA team who presented evidence at the United Nations. It proved Russia's use of various Iranian lethal UAVs in its war on Ukraine.
It flies to a target, impacts it, and then that warhead explodes. This drone has one purpose, and that's to kill.
We come to Berlin. We Americans.
Ronald Reagan's speechwriter joined us to talk about his Tear Down This Wall speech. That was for our show, Glossophobia. That's the scientific term for fear of public speaking. He told us how the president's oratory skills helped change the course of history.
We all understood that this speech was going to be a big speech. It never crossed anybody's mind that it would be a speech that would be remembered many years later.
On our show, Saving the History of the World, we talked about DIA's mission to protect artwork and cultural heritage sites in conflict zones. We spoke with Robert Etzel. His book, The Monuments Men, chronicles a select group of scholar soldiers who had that same mission in World War II.
And the Monuments Men set off on what we now know was the greatest treasure hunt in history. They found millions and millions of objects in thousands of hiding places. It was Aladdin's cave on steroids.
On our episode, The China Incident, you'll hear how, after a mid-air collision, a pilot landed his plane safely and averted an international crisis.
I've heard it from President Bush, Dick Cheney, and Don Rumsfeld said it best. He said, "Shane, you don't get that plane on the ground, we're in another Cold War."
The Right Stuff featured a former DIA analyst who shared his stories about being an intelligence officer in Afghanistan and why he wrote a movie screenplay based on that life-changing experience.
I forever want to be giving back to a cause I believe in. And if I can do justice to not just an agency in D.C., but to the hundreds of thousands of people that work to defend our country, that's a pretty awesome reward at the end of the day.
And our show, Lasers, Asteroids, and the Jetsons, featured an amazing discussion with an expert in extraterrestrial materials and meteorites. He led the NASA mission that landed a spacecraft on an asteroid.
Pristine pieces of a rare, dark, carbon-rich asteroid. The samples from Bennu are an absolute astrobiologist dream.
This is DIA Connections, the best of season 4. Commitment to excellence in defense of the nation. Every single day at the Defense Intelligence Agency, a diverse set of missions execute that core value. Some you might be familiar with, and others, not so much. On the podcast, we love to highlight the not-so-much ones. This season was no exception. Take, for instance, DIA's Cultural Property Protection Office. Their mission is to gather intelligence on cultural heritage sites worldwide, so they'll be protected if they're in an area of conflict. Safeguarding mankind's treasures and symbols of culture was the topic of our show, Saving the History of the World. The special guest on that show was Robert Etzel. His best-selling book, The Monuments Men, tells the story of soldiers who preserved history's greatest masterpieces during World War II. The book was adapted into the 2014 film called The Monuments Men. George Clooney directed and starred in it. Here's a clip from Saving the History of the World. First up is Clooney, followed by author Robert Etzel.
what we're talking about isn't just, you know, these paintings on a wall that some people can look at and get and some can't. It's about culture. It is about these monuments and it is about these sculptures, but it's also just about the fabric of our culture and our history. You know, it is mankind's way of recording history.
Well, the Monuments Men were, and women, were museum curators, directors, art historians, professors, architects, librarians, who volunteered for military service during World War II when they never would have been drafted. Most of them were in their late 30s, early 40s. They had established careers. Many had families. Some had kids. Yet they felt they had a contribution to make in the war, and it was to become a new kind of soldier, one charged with saving, not destroying. There were just a handful of them initially, about a dozen to begin with in 1943 in Italy and a few dozen in Western Europe. Anything that had value was targeted by the Nazis for looting. They were removed and put on trains and trucks back to Germany, hidden in salt mines, caves, and castles.
In a mountain cave near Berchtesgaden, Göring's secret treasure trove was located by American soldiers.
And when the Monuments Men set off on what we now know was the greatest treasure hunt in history, they found millions and millions of objects in thousands of hiding places. It was Aladdin's cave on steroids. If you walked into any major museum in the United States and went to look at the very best works of art that they've got, Americans would be astonished to know how many of the most famous things were during World War II in a salt mine somewhere found by the Monuments Men.
We have an update on that episode, but it's a sad one. Since the show's release, Richard Baranczyk, the last surviving member of the Monuments Men, died at the age of 98. He once said, quote, "Americans cared about the cultural traditions of Europe. We did everything we could to salvage what the Nazis had done. It's the best we could do." DIA's Space and Counterspace Office publishes a threat report called Challenges to Security in Space. The next installment is scheduled to be released this coming spring. John Huth is the chief of that office. On the show, Lasers, Asteroids, and the Jetsons, he explained why protecting space domain is so vital in our everyday lives.
Communications, intelligence support, weather, precision, timing, navigation, all those services come through space or from space.
There's another space subject matter expert on that show, although his area of expertise is far beyond Earth's orbit. Dante Loretta is a Regents Professor of Planetary Science and Cosmochemistry at the University of Arizona. For 12 years, he led NASA's mission to land a spacecraft on an asteroid and return with soil samples that could reveal the secrets to the origin of life.
This is special coverage of America's first asteroid sample return mission, OSIRIS-REx, as it arrives back to Earth after more than 7 years traveling in deep space.
The successful mission was also about determining if and when the asteroid Bennu will hit Earth. Don't worry, we're safe. For now, anyway. Dante Loretta had a pretty cool journey to becoming a world-renowned asteroid hunter. Here's another excerpt from our show, Lasers, Asteroids, and the Jetsons. Dante Loretta grew up in Arizona. It was a location in the desert that he refers to as way off the grid. His family life wasn't great, and his escape came from exploring the world around him.
I started thinking about the adventure, the past, looking for treasures, kind of that adrenaline when you make a discovery. And it made me really think about those who had come before me. And I wondered, who was here before them? And how far back can you go till there has to be an origin? And what is that like? And how does that place us in the general context of this immense cosmos with all these other planets that are out there? Are we alone? Is this a common phenomena, or is it so incredibly rare? We're the only oasis of life in this entire universe.
After 4 years at the University of Arizona, he found himself at a crossroad in life. not knowing what path to take. So he did what felt right. He got in a van with some friends and he followed the dead. To be clear, we're talking about the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, when I was in my late teenage years, I discovered a band called the Grateful Dead. And I showed up at my first concert at the Shoreline Amphitheater in 1990. And this was the biggest party I had ever seen. Thousands of people just throwing down, anything went. It was a wild experience. And I kind of jumped in and enjoyed the time that I spent there.
So Dante, in the words of the great philosopher Jerry Garcia, once in a while you can get shown the light in the strangest of places if you look at it right. That's really the setup for me asking you to share the story of when you saw the light.
I had to pay my own way through college, and I was always working odd jobs. I was particularly good in the kitchen, did a lot of cooking, and in the summer of 1992, I got a job at a local dive bar in Tucson, Arizona called Mike's Place as the breakfast cook. Started at 5 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday mornings, and I usually cooked until about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, just into the lunch shift. It was hard work and didn't pay a whole lot. I knew I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, and I was just looking for that spark, for that inspiration. And I opened up the student newspaper, and there was a job ad that said, "Work for NASA." And man, that really got my mind going. That seemed so exciting. NASA was this beacon of hope. So it was this dream that maybe this was the path.
That was from our episode, Lasers, Asteroids, and the Jetsons. And if you're wondering about the Jetsons in the title of that episode, it's because we spoke with an expert on the 1962 cartoon classic. That TV show predicted the future with uncanny accuracy. We talked about the Visiphone, the Televiewer, and the electronic Snoop, and their 21st century counterparts.
George Jetson is here, Mr. Spacely. He starts the referential unisonic digital indexer machine.
On April 1st, 2001, a U.S. EP-3 Ares plane on a reconnaissance mission over the South China Sea was hit in midair by a Chinese fighter jet. Amazingly, the plane and 24-person crew landed safely on China's Hainan Island. But an international crisis ensued when the Chinese government refused to release the crew members for 11 days. The Defense Intelligence Agency's defense attaché in Beijing was Brigadier General Neil Seelock. He went to Hainan Island and helped secure their release. The pilot of the downed plane was Navy Lieutenant Shane Osborne. He described to us what happened in the air that fateful day in vivid detail. This is from our episode, The China Incident.
He'd already almost hit us once. And this time he came in too fast. And he tried to slow his aircraft down by pitching his nose up and pulling throttle back. When he pitched his nose up, guess what? The airplane went up, and that's when he slammed into our left wing. And it cut him in half, where his tail met his fuselage. With my far left propeller, it literally chopped him in half. And as his plane broke apart, his tail flew up and went through my aileron and my wing and tore a hole through it. And the aileron's what turns the airplane left and right. So as that happened, the aircraft rolls hard left. We're flipping inverted. As we flipped inverted, we had a second collision, and the nose of his aircraft hit the nose of my airplane, tearing the nose of my airplane off. The next thing I know, I'm flipped up inverted. I'm looking up at the South China Sea, and we're dead.
Osborne saw the Chinese fighter jets spiral towards the sea, and a grayish-white parachute drift away. The pilot was never found.
They ask me all the time, did you start praying? And I said, I'm a man of prayer. I have been all my life. This was not time to pray. I was pissed. I was like, this guy just killed us. And I was mad.
The plane fell 2 miles upside down before Osborne was able to get it right side up. He gave the crew instructions to get their parachutes on and prepare to jump. Saving lives was the priority, but there were also directives. That's the official term, meaning get rid of the top secret material in the event of an emergency and land. But with severe damage to the plane and the base 3 hours away, that wasn't an option.
So I started making mayday calls, started telling the crew to activate the emergency destruction checklist. And what does that mean? Get all the top secret material, put it in metal suitcases, punch holes in it with an axe, throw it out of the emergency exit, and it goes into the bottom of the South China Sea. Nobody's ever going to find it.
So Shane, what about ditching the plane? That's landing the plane on the water, right? Was that a possibility?
I couldn't ditch in the ocean, even though I wasn't supposed to, but there's a huge dish underneath. I had no controllability. My nose was gone. That would have dug in with the dish underneath, and we would have cartwheeled, and it would have killed everybody. If everybody would have bailed out, they would have been eaten by sharks or never found. You might have got a few of the crew back, but that wasn't a great option.
Using the aviation skills of a superbly trained pilot, Shane Osborne was able to land on Hainan Island. The crew was shaken, but unhurt. Then came the unwelcome party.
An armed troop carrier with a bunch of guys with AK-47s coming to greet us. I went back to the crew in the tube, and everybody's scared. There's people puking. And I just said, nobody speaks to anyone unless I'm standing there telling you to speak to them. This is going to suck. But stick together and finish the mission.
...75% of the population has a fear of public speaking. The scientific term for it is glossophobia, and that's the title of the podcast that we did about it. Presenting intelligence to an audience of policymakers is an important part of a DIA officer's job. And it's not easy. It must be done without sweating, or trembling. At DIA, the group who offers guidance in overcoming the fear is called dialoguers, as in DIA loggers. Pretty clever, right? We wanted to know more about what it takes to deliver the perfect speech, so we asked Peter Robinson to tell us. He was President Ronald Reagan's speechwriter. Robinson wrote the famous "Tear Down This Wall" speech that Reagan delivered at the Berlin Wall in 1987. It's one for the ages. In the first clip from Glossophobia, you'll hear about someone I'm sure you'll be familiar with who didn't like the idea of Reagan using the term "tear down this wall." Peter, the Deputy National Security Advisor at the time, was General Colin Powell, and you had a somewhat spirited discussion with him about the line. Mainly, he wanted it out, and you didn't. How'd that meeting go?
Colin Powell got pretty rough with me. He was not used to insubordination from young men. And, of course, as a very senior Army officer, he thought that he ought to be able to command a certain respect, and he had an idea about the way you treated young men who didn't provide the respect that he considered his due. And he just shouted at me. He let me have it. And you know what I did? I shouted right back at him. I just shouted right back at him. And he was so startled. I don't know which of us was more startled than the other. The point of all this is that when the president said he especially wanted to deliver that line, those who objected to the line, which is the State Department, National Security Council, and Colin Powell, really had only two options. One was to go to the president himself and say, "You're mistaken." And lo and behold, they were reticent to do that.
Yeah, I can see why. What was option number two?
The other option was to go to me, because if I had written a memorandum saying, "Dear Mr. President, on mature reflection, I think that one passage I wrote may be out of order. Let me substitute this material," the president would probably have deferred to the speechwriter who had gone and done original reporting on the scene in Berlin. And that's why Colin Powell hollered at me, I hollered back, and he just stood up and walked out. There wasn't much he could do to me. He couldn't send me to the brig. I wasn't some sort of junior officer whom he could discipline. So if I stood my ground, they really had no place to go, and I did.
Peter Robinson wrote the speech, but oddly enough, he wasn't there to witness President Reagan making it.
I was too junior to join the traveling party, and I ended up watching the speech from my bachelor pad in Arlington, Virginia. And up to that very moment, I had no idea whether the president would deliver the draft as I wrote it, or whether by then state and the NSC would have succeeded in suppressing it and replacing the draft that I wrote with a draft of their own. So I turn on my little Sony Trinitron and listen to him deliver the speech.
24 years ago, President John F. Kennedy visited Berlin.
Little tiny screen, so I'm sitting close to it so I can see him. He starts with the introduction, which I'd written. I recognized every word, and then I get more and more and more tense.
We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together. The advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace.
There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable. And now I can barely breathe, because he's right there with the buildup.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate.
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And I can barely remember the rest of the speech because I felt such relief. I remember just sitting on the floor feeling so relieved. Now, this is what a worm I was. Did I think, what a blow for freedom. What a good speech for him to deliver for the sake of the West Berlin people. No, all I thought was, those bastards at state, we beat them.
Analysts have been called the backbone of the Defense Intelligence Agency. They are responsible for delivering relevant, timely, and accurate intelligence products to policymakers. This season, we did two very different shows about them. First is our episode, The Right Stuff, and right is W-R-I-T-E. We told the story of Mitchell LaFortune. He joined the military and worked in Army intelligence for over a decade. Then, at DIA, he helped develop counterinsurgency strategy during deployments in Afghanistan. He also wrote intel reports for DIA's Middle East Africa Regional Center. He decided to combine his experiences abroad with the writing skills he developed as an analyst and pursue his lifelong passion of writing movie screenplays. In 2023, the movie he wrote, Kandahar, starring Gerard Butler, played in theaters across America. It's based on the 2013 event that rocked the intelligence community while he was working in Afghanistan. This is From the Right Stuff.
Good morning. We're following breaking news on Meet the Press this morning. Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker, he is on the run just as government authorities are charging him with the leaking of classified information. We're going to talk to Glenn Greenwald.
American officials are warning other governments that the Snowden leaks could reveal their intelligence operations. And this morning,
it was so dynamic and distinct. We were really concerned that the cover of many of our operatives and sources, assets, could be potentially blown. When you're working on the ground in that type of situation and you don't know if there's risk to yourself, is there a risk to your family? Are there risks to your translators and the people that are risking their lives every day? It was terrifying.
There's a powerful scene where Gerard Butler's character is with his translator. I'd like to play that scene and then get your thoughts.
We rely on you guys for everything. I mean, the language, the culture. You risk your life for us.
We rely on you guys for everything. On your deployments, you spend so much time with these translators.
A lot of time.
Right. And they are really the unheralded heroes that sacrifice everything to keep everyone safe.
That's really the heart of the story. Like the Edward Snowden stuff and the Iran things, like those are just triggers. Those are the plot points to move something in a real fast direction with action. But for me, doing that work, you'd spend 6 hours in a car with a guy that you barely know. And you have to become reliant upon them. If something bad happens, the shit hits the fan, you can trust them with their lives and they can trust you.
I want to change it up a little bit and ask, if you think back to some of the work that you did at DIA, and I'm talking about writing intelligence reports, do you think that it made you better at what you do now? And if so, how?
100%. 100%. Storytelling is structure. For me, like the rules of screenwriting, they're so strict. It's just like writing a PDB. It's the same idea. You have a set structure as to how it's supposed to look. You have a review process that's very complicated. You know, you do a lot of work not to know if someone is going to finally read all the stuff that you really wanted them to. It's structure where you find true creativity. That's why movies, to me, are so much more interesting than books, and all I do is read books. You have to fit into a 2-hour block of time. It's 120 pages, one page per minute. Very set, specific rules. Rules reward creativity. They encourage it.
We have an update on former DIA analyst Mitchell LaFortune. His next film, called Last Breath, starring Woody Harrelson, comes out in February of 2025. It's a true story about a rescue mission to recover a missing diver. Going from writing intel reports at DIA to writing lines for Woody in LA. Now that sounds like a movie too. Cheers, Mitchell. The podcast that attracted the most attention in season 4 was Show and Tell, Iranian UAVs in Ukraine. That one told the story of a team of analysts who collected physical proof of Iranian UAVs being used by Russia in their war with Ukraine. Propellers, crankshafts, rotary engines, wing stabilizers, and more were all taken to the United Nations and put on display for 42 member nations and multiple media outlets to see. All so they could understand the threat that Iranian drones represent. The team also created a detailed, unclassified 14-page, 11x17 report. It featured side-by-side photo comparisons of drones used in attacks. It became a clear and effective tool used by policymakers and the media to expose Iran's involvement. Here's the team lead describing when the report was used by CNN during an interview with the Iranian foreign minister in 2023.
So there was a morning in early March when there was a tweet by Christiane Amanpour, a CNN foreign correspondent who often interviews very high-level foreign dignitaries, and was advertising an interview that she had upcoming with Iran's foreign minister, Emil Abdollahian.
Foreign minister, welcome to the program.
Christiane Amanpour is a 14-time Emmy Award winner and CNN's chief international anchor. The interview with the Iranian foreign minister was mostly about Iran's human rights violations, until she flipped the script on him.
But first I want to ask you about another really important thing, and that is about Iranian weapons to Russia that are targeting Ukrainians during this war.
And as it's going through, all of a sudden it cuts to these images where she's taking the actual photographs from the book. She's taking the analysis we've done. She puts it in front of him and essentially asks the foreign minister.
You've probably seen these pictures, right? So that is an Iranian drone that was found inside and recovered from Ukraine. This as well, with the president of Ukraine standing next to it. This, they have compared this is the Ukrainians.
Who says that?
This is the Ukrainians, and this is from open sources from, like, Yemen and other...
How can they prove this drone with just a photograph?
Are you denying it? Okay. Are these two the same things?
And you kind of watch him for the next 3-4 minutes stumble through, never have a great answer.
Why are you sending drones to violating all sorts of sanctions, but still also causing a huge amount of death?
It's a really incredible moment to see a piece that you have done have an impact that way, that someone is taking this, putting it in front of the foreign minister of the country who is doing the act you're accusing of, and say, how is this not you? It was a really, really incredible moment. One I will note, too, we did not ask CNN to do. We didn't even know they were going to do this. And that was, in a way, an example of the success we had. we put this piece out to be a tool not just for policymakers or for foreign governments, it's for the public to use too. And the fact that another organization, in this case a media organization, picked it up and confronted the foreign minister with it, to us, that's one of the biggest wins you can get.
The year-long effort to spread the word on the report earned the team the Intelligence Community's Strategic Communications Integration Award. The report was a real game changer. And since it's unclassified, you can check it out for yourself on DIA.mil. Well, that's a wrap on Season 4. We're glad for the opportunity to bring you stories that have interesting connections to DIA, and we hope they connect with you. And we're really glad that we'll be doing it again for Season 5. We hope you'll continue to listen and tell us what you think. As always, thanks for listening to DIA Connections.